Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Tim Goddard, registration number 17645, and I represent the appellate defendant below, Circle Properties LLC. I know you've read the briefs, so I'm not going to go back into the argument I presented in the briefs or the facts of the case. What I want to focus on is why we're here today and why we believe the trial court made a reversible error in its legal analysis. Not factual findings, legal analysis. And why I say that is because the contract at issue is the commercial contract. I represent the seller. Section 21 of that contract provides a contractual remedy. That is a provision that the parties agreed upon, that if this occurred, this is your remedy. And that provision states, it's quoted in our brief, time is of the essence hereof. If any note or check received as earnest money hereunder, or any payment due hereunder is not paid, honored or tendered when due, seller may elect to treat this contract as canceled, in which case all earnest money, whether or not paid by buyer, shall be paid to seller and retained by seller. That is a contractual remedy provision as a matter of law. Now, why my client failed below is that Circle Properties exercised its right to cancel the contract by providing written notice of cancellation when the buyer failed, undeniably failed, to provide the second earnest money deposit. As we discussed in our brief, the earnest money deposit was split into two at the request of the buyer so that he could pay portion of it up front and portion of it later after the inspection process.
Mr. Goddard,
yes.
In addition to the time is of the essence clause, isn't the payment of the earnest money in two tranches also a condition of the contract?
It is a condition to keep the contract alive, and we discussed that in our brief, Your Honor.
And aren't all conditions material?
They are, Your Honor, but in this sense, this contract tells you what is material. And it tells you that if any note or check received as earnest money is not paid, that's material. You have the right to cancel. So there should be a determinant. This is what the trial court should have done. Did the condition of cancellation arise? Did the buyer fail to make an earnest money payment when due? Answer to that question is unequivocally yes. He said he forgot. He has excuses why, but undeniably the record is clear, no payment was made when due. So then the next question is, what does the contract tell us should be done? Well, the contract says seller may cancel the contract. So did seller properly exercise the right to cancel the contract? Absolutely. The seller undeniably sent written notice of cancellation. Why my client was found liable is because my client would not revoke the cancellation clause and proceed to closing. And the trial court then went off into this substantial breach of materiality in cases that had nothing to do with the cancellation clause and said, well, since you didn't reinstate the contract, therefore you're in breach of the contract because you didn't close. And furthermore, that as long as the buyer was ready, willing, and able to close, it really doesn't matter whether you cancel the contract because it's not a material breach. What kind of reasoning is that? It completely ignores the cancellation clause, that contractual remedy that the parties agreed upon. And that is why we're here today. Now, if you look at that cancellation clause, it's a very simple clause. And it's the same issue that was raised in the, we cited in our reply brief, the Texas case of Limestone Group, Inc. They beautifully address this issue. You don't get into substantial breach. You don't get into materiality. You don't even look to those cases when you have a contractual remedy provision. Why? Well, because the Supreme Court said in Fox a long time ago that as long as you parties don't violate public policy or statutory provisions, in how they choose to draft the contract, it's up to the court to interpret the contract and enforce it as the parties agreed. If you don't, if you have trial courts going out there and just completely ignoring a contractual remedy that was provided for and going off on a tangent down whether this was a substantial breach or material or whatever, then you get these bizarre rulings like we have in this case.
Now, well, Mr. Goddard, yes. let me ask you a question here. I know that your opposing counsel is arguing that there was a waiver of this clause by conduct, and could you address that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I'll jump forward to the waiver. One thing, if I have one point to make, one thing I want you to take away with this, is waiver has always been in Colorado the intentional relinquishment of a known right. That has always been the law in Colorado. And you cannot have waiver of a breach unless you know a breach occurred. Now, if you look at the trial court's findings, paragraph 20 through 23, I'll tell you paragraph 20. Shortly thereafter, Ms. Christ discovered that neither Stickland Investments nor AIP had paid the additional earnest money. Paragraph 21, prior to the discovery that the additional earnest money had not been made. Paragraph 22, the evidence at trial showed that between July and September 2012, all parties had forgotten about the additional earnest money payment deadline. Paragraph 23, on September 7, 2012, following defendant's discovery that Stickland Investments had not paid the additional earnest money deposit. Prior to that time, she had no my client had no knowledge that the breach had occurred. Again, the plaintiff's side was that they forgot to make the deposit, but it's clear the trial court found, and those are the findings that you're bound to, that Circle Properties had no knowledge of the breach until shortly before sent notice of cancellation. Matter of fact, it's days, within days of discovering the breach. Now, should have discovered the breach is a different standard, but waiver has never, and I've not found any case in Colorado or in any other jurisdiction that said waiver can be supported by you should have known of a breach or in the exercise of due diligence you should have known of the breach. That's just not been the law on waiver. Waiver has always been the intentional relinquishment of a known right. And while I'm on waiver, if I could address one other issue real quick, and it's cited in our brief, and that is, well, isn't waiver just a factual finding of the trial court that we're bound by? No, in this case, we have undisputed facts, and that undisputed facts that I just cited to you is that Circle Properties had no knowledge of the breach until shortly before Circle Properties sent notice of cancellation. And I cited the Duran case, also Kaiser v. Markets Supreme Court cases that say that you certainly can take the undisputed facts and apply it to the law and say, do these undisputed facts rise to the level of a waiver? That is certainly your job. Not to remake factual findings. That's not what I'm asking for. I'm just asking for application of the law.
Where there's an application of an equitable remedy, the question is there factual support for it? That's the argument you're making. That's the way I hear the argument.
Yeah, what I'm saying is not so much equitable, but whether the facts rise to the level of what the law says you need for a waiver. That's what I'm saying. But on equity, and I've addressed these cases in my brief, but it's another bizarre finding of the trial court, or its analysis, is that just because you ask for specific performance, I no longer have to follow the contract. Now, because the plaintiff says specific performance and equity abhors forfeiture, well, we'll just ignore the cancellation clause. And that's exactly what happened. But that's not consistent with what the Supreme Court said in Ballo, as we cited in our brief. In Ballo, the Supreme Court said a trial court cannot rewrite the contract and then and then require the other party to specifically perform that contract. It's never been the job of a trial court or any court to rewrite a contract. The job is to enforce the contract. I just say quickly that cancellation clauses are enforceable. We cited several cases where the courts have enforced cancellation clauses. I want to just briefly, and I want to save the rest of my time for rebuttal, but I just want to briefly address this issue of what about the time of the essence? What does that time of the essence clause do? Because even without the time of the essence, cancellation clause would still give Circle Properties the right to cancel the contract when the deposit was not made. What the cancellation clause does is it enhances that cancellation clause. And according to the Duran case, the Supreme Court's Duran case, it said it becomes such a material matter as to require exact compliance with the terms of the contract in this respect. Now, you look, Duran is not a cancellation clause case. Duran says that even if you didn't have a cancellation clause, if you don't perform and there's a time of the essence clause in there, and I don't want to get into the time of the essence of fact and all that, but Duran just enhances that clause. But I just want to be clear that that time of the essence is not required for that cancellation clause. If it didn't even say time of the essence, you'd still have the right to cancel the contract under the plain terms of the contract. What about Rohrhauer v. Little? I want to just briefly address that. Well, that's a title issue. That's not a payment issue. And we cited several cases explaining the difference between a payment issue. Payment is a definite thing. If you look at the contract and you look at the provisions in 8.1 and 8.3 related to title, what is the remedy for failure to provide title? Well, it's contractually agreed upon. You extend the time period for providing the title. I'm sorry, you extend the time period for the title objection as a matter of fairness. So it's not surprising that under Rohrhauer v. Little, the Supreme Court would say, well, it's not really that important because everybody's agreed that you extend the title deadline anyway. So as long as you have sufficient time before closing to review the title and make your objections, then it's a no harm, no foul situation. Not the same situation with a payment obligation. And I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Goddard.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Steve Kelly, registration number 16370. With me at council table is my colleague, Leisha McKinley. We represent the appellees. Circle Properties' appeal rests on the proposition that an entire line of Colorado case law regarding substantial performance and material breach can be rendered a nullity by describing Circle's actions as a cancellation of the contract as opposed to an effort to create a forfeiture of the buyer's rights.
Well, Mr. Kelly, let me ask you, how can you have substantial performance of a contract when a condition has failed?
Your Honor, it's not a condition.
And why is it not a condition?
Well, first of all, failure of conditions precedent was never pled, not generally, not with the specificity required under Rule 9C.
Don't we review the contract de novo here?
You do, Your Honor. But the argument has to have been raised at the trial court. And at the trial court and in the briefing, until they sort of started to reach it in the reply brief, in the briefing and in the trial court, it was always treated as a breach of covenant issue. That's what was argued, and it was expressly discussed in closing argument, that because of how Colorado case law looks at conditions and covenants, and in particular the Rohrhauer case, because of how Colorado looks at conditions and covenant. This was treated as a covenant.
But you filed the complaint.
We did.
And your complaint specified that there had been substantial performance.
We did, yes.
And again, I ask, as a matter of law, how can your complaint state a claim when a condition has failed in a contract?
Your Honor, because that's what Colorado law requires. The trial court applied Colorado law regarding time is of the essence provision, substantial performance, and material breach exactly as required by numerous Colorado Supreme Court cases and by numerous cases from this court.
Mr. Kelly, do any of those cases involve a cancellation clause, though?
Yes, they do, Your Honor.
Because here's my question. Let's assume that I agree with you that it wasn't a material, that the earnest money, the timely payment of the earnest money wasn't necessarily material to the parties. However, it wasn't paid, so that would be a breach, even if it's a minor breach, and the cancellation clause kicks in if it's not paid.
Your Honor, Colorado law requires that that be looked at as a forfeiture. And numerous cases, Rohauer involved a termination provision. Huey versus Davis had a termination provision. All of these cases involve cancellation rights. Nevertheless, Colorado case law, Colorado Supreme Court, requires that we go through the analysis of is time is of the essence as a matter of fact. We go through the analysis of whether it was substantial performance, whether it was a material breach.
Whether or not time is of the essence, I guess the question that I'm concerned with is, how can you forfeit something if you have no awareness of the true facts? And aren't all the forfeiture cases that require some knowledge on the part of the seller? And here it would appear, based upon the trial court's own findings, that the seller was not aware that a condition in the contract had not been met. In fact, she assumed, I take it, that it had been in fact met.
Your Honor, that of course is not clear from the record as to what caused her to not look. What was clear was when an issue mattered, when time was of the essence as a matter of fact, seller and seller's counsel were on top of the issue. There was a loan conditions deadline. The day of the loan conditions deadline, I believe it's Exhibit 29, there's an email that goes out. We're confirming that the loan conditions deadline has passed and that we're moving forward with the contract. When a date mattered, there was factual support that the parties treated it as something that mattered. And Colorado law is very clear that it must be of the essence as a matter of fact.
Let me ask you this question. The trial court did find that seller forgot that the payment was due and apparently did not discover that it was not paid. And so can you address that? Because aren't we bound by that fact?
Yes, we are. But both parties, the trial court found that both parties appeared to have forgotten of the issue. And we're bound by that fact.
So is forgetting sufficient to show a forfeiture or a waiver?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Waiver can be shown even when without knowledge of all the specific facts. That's the upshot of the Mountain Stone versus Hammond case, where there was waiver of lien rights, and that waiver was upheld, even though the claimants did not know at the time of the waiver that they were not going to be paid by the contractor. And Williston, on contracts, directly addresses this precise issue. A party cannot claim ignorance of the mispayment. Ms. Price can't complain ignorance of the mispayment as an excuse. And I'll quote Williston, because she's presumed to know those things, including matters concerning the other party's performance or failure to perform, which reasonable diligence on her part would bring to her attention.
Constructive knowledge.
Yes, and it's both constructive knowledge under the analysis of the information is available, but also charged with knowledge with what you would have learned had you inquired.
What section of Williston is that?
It is 39 at 22. And she testified that all she had to do to find out was call the title company, and that she could have done that earlier.
Okay, and so I know your reliance on Williston. Are there Colorado cases that follow suit and apply that?
I have not found Colorado cases studying this section of Williston. Okay. Williston has, of course, been followed in numerous other cases, but I have not found anything on this specific provision. But what I believe is very important for this court to look at and to analyze and to understand what the trial court was doing and what both parties were arguing about at the trial court. It was not whether this was a condition. That argument was not raised at the trial court. But the parties, the court, and both parties were discussing the time is of the essence provision. And Huey versus Davis is very clear. And the Supreme Court says, this court has held that an express contractual provision stating that time is of the essence is not conclusive where there is nothing in the record to show that time was of the essence in fact. And that's the same holdings in Jones versus McKinney, Rocky Mountain Gold Mines, this court's holding in Commonwealth Petroleum Company versus Billings, where this court said in 1987, even though an agreement provides that timely performance is of the essence, such a provision is not conclusive upon the point. It must still be shown that time was, in fact, of the essence. The sole law that the appellant relies upon here is this Limestone case, a case that was not cited until the reply brief. Now, Limestone involved a very unique and particular specific performance language. It provided, if purchaser shall not be in default hereunder and seller fails to perform, then purchaser has a specific performance right. Our language was different. And of course, in Limestone, the default was a failure to ever pay the earnest money deposit, not a timing issue, but a failure to ever pay it. Limestone, in fact, has been distinguished by another Texas Court of Appeals panel on these very grounds. A case called Crandall Medical Consulting versus Harrell that can be found at 2009 Westlaw 280658. That's 280658. And that panel distinguished Limestone in two ways. The first, the purchase and sale contract had different specific performance language. It didn't have this, if purchaser shall not be in default here under, which our contract doesn't have either. And in Crandall, the full purchase price had been tendered. And based on those two distinguishing facts, the Crandall court went on and applied the materiality and substantial performance test, just like the test that's required in Colorado.
In those cases, had a cancellation clause actually been invoked and had a contract been canceled?
In Crandall, yes. In Limestone involved a very long and delayed, continually extended out closing process. And in Limestone, the closing was being delayed because of pendency of another lawsuit challenging the development project. The seller didn't inform the buyer of the end of that litigation. And after a period of time passed, after the end of the litigation, the seller canceled. The buyer never attempted to resurrect the contract, never tendered the additional earnest money deposit, and simply sued for specific performance despite never having cured that breach. And under those circumstances, the Texas case, unlike Colorado law, said we're not going to look at substantial performance and materiality. We're not even going to look at it. Colorado case law, though, requires that we do that. That's what happened in Rohauer. That was in Huey versus Davis. Rohauer had a time is of the essence clause and a termination provision in the event that performance was untimely. And Rohauer then went on and said where there's doubt as to whether a contractual provision is intended as a promise or a condition, it is preferable to construe the provision as a promise, thereby avoiding the potentially harsh effect of a forfeiture that can result in some cases by a contrary construction. And it's undoubtedly an understanding of the Rohauer analysis as to why this issue wasn't presented, wasn't tried, wasn't argued at the trial court. The condition argument was not raised. It's an affirmative defense, and it must be pled with particularity under 9C, and it was not done. You know, this court has held in the context of discussing equity's abhorrence of a forfeiture, a court of equity will not enforce a forfeiture if the party insisting upon it may be made whole otherwise. That's Nielsen versus Woods. And in that case, a forfeiture argument was raised and rejected because the breach was not gross or willful. The breach complained of was of an act that could, quote, be done afterwards so as to put the party seeking forfeiture precisely in the same situation as he would have been but for the breach. That's what we're in here. That's the situation here. That's the analysis that was required by numerous holdings of this court. It's the analysis that was required under Interbank Investments LLC. And this court cannot ignore its own law or the law of the Supreme Court. And if I can talk briefly about the waiver issue and the contention that this court should review waiver de novo. The waiver issue was disputed at trial. It's not as if the facts regarding waiver were undisputed. Those facts were disputed, and this court then is bound by the factual finding of waiver. Ms. Christ disputed whether she ignored her own deadlines for her own performance under the contract. She disputed whether she changed her mind about proceeding with the sale. And she disputed whether she changed her mind before learning that the second deposit had not been paid. She disputed the timing of when she determined the deposit had not been paid. And she disputed whether she told the buyer that she just wanted to ensure that the property was sold after she learned that the deposit had not been paid. And that statement was after she learned. And she still said that. Those facts support the waiver finding. And this court is bound by that waiver finding. The district court went into great length on the waiver finding. And those findings are supported by the evidence. Because the waiver finding is supported by the evidence, that finding alone must be affirmed, as well as the other findings. Circle's argument, as this court, and is dependent upon this court's ignoring Colorado law on time is of the essence, on material breach, on substantial performance, and the absence of any harm from the delayed payment of the earnest money deposit. Circle's argument asks this court to ignore buyer's performance at closing and asks this court to ignore the fact that Circle received the full benefit of its bargain. It got exactly what it bargained for. This court should reject Circle's arguments as contrary to Colorado law, and we ask the court to affirm the findings and remand this case for determination and award of the additional attorney's fees that the appellees are entitled to recover under the prevailing party provision of the contract.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Goddard?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have about 2.5 minutes.
And 227?
Yes, sir.
Okay. First of all, we are not asking the court to ignore Colorado law. If you look at the cases that involve termination clauses or contractual termination provisions, Albright Supreme Court case, it deals with a failure to agree upon a condition of the property, and the buyer wants it to be repaired, provides notice of repair, seller and buyer don't agree, contract says it terminates automatically. That's Albright. Mining NE Inc. v. Islip Monaco Associates, it's in our opening brief at 15. That's a termination clause. Court enforced it. The cases that Mr. Kelly's relying upon, if you look at those cases are not decided on the cancellation clause, including the Rohrhauer case. None of those cases you're going to see facts where it says seller invoked the cancellation clause, but the trial court said you can't cancel the contract because it wasn't substantial or it wasn't material breach or whatever. Along that line, the same argument Mr. Kelly just made to you, if you look in the record, in his closing argument at the trial court, and his legal argument, same argument, the counter argument that was made by counsel in the trial court was in fact that no, the contract defines what is a material breach. The contract defines what is substantial performance. And this was non-payment, judge, and you should follow the contract. That argument was, in fact, not only raised, it was argued in the trial court, and the trial court simply ignored it and went off on the same path that Mr. Kelly asked you to follow, which is let's go to the Colorado cases on substantial performance and materiality that did not involve cancellation clauses.
I guess the part that's a little confusing to me is that the purpose of the earnest money is to make sure that a party closes, to help ensure that the closing occurs. And so I guess what seems a little circular to me is that here they're canceling based on a provision that's supposed to ensure closing. So could you just sort of articulate how the harm works in that situation?
Yeah, what the earnest money does is it assures that the buyer is in the game and that the buyer has the funds available to close, or more importantly, it puts up security for damages if the buyer doesn't have the money, because the buyer, like in this case, could have no assets.
Right, but here the buyer indeed wanted to close.
After the contract was canceled, then the buyer suddenly puts up the money. Now, what we don't know is whether the buyer was using this as a strategy, as another means of keeping the contract open, keeping his options available, so that if I decide I don't want to close, then all I'm out is $20,000, I'm not out $80,000. That's the problem. But more importantly, the contract itself says that if you don't make the payment, you can exercise the right to cancel. And just I just want to say in closing that what we request this court to do is to reverse the trial court's decision. And I don't think you need to remand it, because I think you can find, based upon the record and your own interpretation of the contract, that Circle Properties had a right to cancel that contract, properly did cancel the contract, and you can't have specific performance of a canceled contract. Therefore, Circle Properties should have been the prevailing party. You should reverse the trial court's award of damages, as well as the award of attorney fees. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Goddard. Thank you again, Mr. Kelly. Thanks to both counsel for your arguments today. I think they were helpful to us. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.